Hello and welcome to The Canon, the show where every single week we get together and debate, argue, and sometimes harmoniously agree about which films belong in the canon of all-time greats to live on forever. I am, as always, your co-host, Devin Faraci, and joining me also, as always,
your co-host, Amy Nicholson.
Amy, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm less sick.
That's beautiful.
Than I was last time. I mean, it was just a couple of days ago we recorded. We're recording it, quite early in the week, and I'm much better than I was.
Well, you have a much better haircut. Yeah, for people who can't see Devin right now, he's got a gorgeous Silver Fox haircut going on.
I did get a haircut. I'm ready for my Money Monster interviews. Me and George doing the Silver Fox thing together. So last week we did what did we do last week?
Last week we did The Lost Weekend.
That's right, we did Lost
Weekend. Your memory is really failing.
I have really done it.
We have just had a weekend in between doing these two episodes and already.
Yes, we did do The Lost Weekend. And I'm curious, what did the listeners at home have to say about Lost Weekend?
Well, it was very close. This was a very, very close episode. And the results are in. The Lost Weekend will be forgotten. I am sorry, The Lost Weekend. You did not make it into the canon. It was not spiteful. It was a lot of soft no's, kind of like how I felt. Billy Wilder, I'm sure we're going to see you again and again and again.
You know, one of the things I liked about this Lost Weekend episode was that I think a lot of really interesting discussion came out of it. You know, and a lot of people, I think, wrestling with sort of the question of historicity as regards to the canon, and especially social history, because that was, I think, the big argument for Lost Weekend was very much the social history and the way that the movie, you know, impacted our culture. You know, so Breiwicht said that, you know, it was soft yes there. The historical significance is what pushed it over the edge for me. There's a couple of soft yeses for the historical significance. A funny username that went with you, Amy, hit the nail on the head for me. It's good, but I can't really get excited about it. He went with a soft yes based on the historical and cultural impact.
Yeah, it's been interesting ever since we started doing old movies, which was fairly early on in doing the canon. This question of historicity keeps coming up, and I've seen a lot of the comments saying, and I agree with them for a lot of the part, like if you do an old important movie that did influence things, doesn't it just have to get in based on its role in the culture? Basically, isn't any old movie that had any influence on anything automatically going to be worthy of the canon? And I think this was a good example of trying to really parse out, you know, do all old films that are great, that are considered classics, belong in the canon?
And it's a question of what the influence is, right? Because there are some influences that are minor, some influences that are big. I think The Lost Weekend ended up being a really interesting debate because it's right on that cusp where the movie's good. I quite like the movie, but I get why some people find it, you know, fine. But the question of the historical impact is so cultural, and it's right on the verge of, is this – you know, again, for me, like I said, it was about, I'm going to go head spin over here, saying that the word alcoholism was still fringe in 1945. And it's easy to imagine how little help people had in wrapping their minds around the behavior of an alcoholic before it came into fashion. That guy, by the way, went no.
Yeah.
Even though he recognized the historicity of it.
That's true. And I will say, you know, that historicity, is that even a word? I feel like we just made up that word.
I'm a writer.
Historicity.
I'm a writer. Not all of us are music television people. Some of us are actual writers.
Hey, I'm just going to – can we just have podcast dead silence while I glare at you? Let's say historical impact. I feel like that's a real world.
Sure.
Word. Right after we did that episode, I went and welcomed a good friend of ours, Meredith Warner, to moving to my part of K-Town. And we wandered around and we drank way too much soju. And I woke up in the morning and I thought, oh, I am having a lost weekend. That was my lost weekend night. And the film felt a new Relevance? No, not relevance. What is that word?
Relevance.
Relevance. Yeah.
Relevance.
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 I'm obviously still recovering.
Well, thank you guys all for weighing in. You know, this is the stuff that I like the best is when we have a movie that sort of engenders that kind of discussion that's a little bit off the beaten path and is a little bit – some of that stuff was personal too, people talking about their own experience with alcohol as well. I thought it was really great. Thank you guys so much for being a cool audience, and hopefully – you guys are going to be a cool audience for this one too, because we have chosen a movie that I think is a little more off the beaten path. I'm going to say that I'm going to be honest about this. This was a hole for me. I had not seen Pathar Panchali, the film that we're seeing next. Pathar Panchali, of course, is directed, Sam, right? It's directed by the famed and beloved Indian director
Shutujitrai.
I practice pronouncing that. So
you can say that. Come on.
I can say
Shutujitrai
very easily. This was a hole for me. Indian cinema was a hole for me. I've seen Bollywood pictures. And I've seen a couple of weird movies coming out of India, but some of the early classical Indian cinema was totally new to me. So this was kind of an exciting episode.
Yeah, it would make sense because Pather Panchali was actually a film that was almost considered lost for a long time. It only recently got its like gorgeous Criterion restoration in a way that made people able to see it properly. It was burned in a fire.
Somebody said die in a fire on the internet and somebody took it seriously. It's terrible. Terrible that happens.
That's the worst joke ever.
When Amy walked in, she asked if I got a haircut, and I said I got all of them cut. So that's the worst joke ever.
Can I get a new podcast co-host?
Why don't you get Michael Shannon to co-host your podcast?
That would be great.
Right?
Do you know how much that would actually be
really great. So Pather Panchali, Satyajit Rai.
Close enough.
Satyajit Rai.
Directed this film in 1955. It is one of the earliest examples of Indian cinema, and it is nothing like what we consider. When you think of an Indian movie today, you think of these big Bollywood movies, 3.5 hour long, endless musical numbers, gaudy, bright, silly, weird. This is nothing like this. This is a film heavily influenced by the Italian neorealism, and is much more of a slice of life story with a slight backbone of a plot.
Yeah, this might be a weird parallel, and it probably doesn't even work that well. But Satyajit Rai was sort of the Richard Linklater of his area of India. Like, he was a young kid who was really interested in film, who started a film club in his neighborhood, and then eventually made his first film. And the one we're talking about, Pather Panchali, is his very first film. This is his slacker, if you will.
And it's the film that really kicked off Indian film in general. So I had never seen it. I knew nothing about it. I knew the cover. I knew that it was part of the Apu trilogy. I knew it was the story of a boy growing up. I kind of walked in thinking we were going to watch 400 Blows Chicken Tikka Masala edition. And it was not that. Chicken Tikka Masala, by the way, is not a traditional Indian dish. It's a colonial dish. I know that. Before anybody leaves a nasty comment.
I got very worried about you right there.
I am fully aware. We have a wonderful Indian writer on our staff who lives in Mumbai who I antagonize with the way that I eat Indian food. I send him pictures of me eating colonial Indian dishes and telling him how much I enjoy his traditional foods. So believe me, I know, I get it. I thought it was going to be sort of a 400 blows sort of kind of a thing, and it is absolutely nothing like that, and it is so much richer and more interesting than what I expected it to be.
Yeah. No, this film, like right from the beginning of Pather Panchali, you realize – you're seeing a film through the eyes of Satyajit Rai, and he's showing you a world that can seem sort of familiar, but with some characters you've never seen in it before, like
right.
characters you've never seen in a film ever. One of the first characters you meet is a woman called the Auntie, who's very, very, very old. The actress herself was in her 80s when she played this role.
She looks like a mummy.
Yeah, she's wrinkled from head to toe. As soon as you see her, you suck in your breath and you're like, oh God, is this character going to die? When is this character going to die? And she's hunched over, and you've never seen anything like that before in film, I feel like, in 55 when this came out. And I feel like it's rare to see a character like that today. But this film goes on to have more of a story and more of a world building. It's not just a coming-of-age story set in an exotic place. I feel like it is its own film on its own terms, populated by happenstance, by people we don't know.
Well, I think what's really great about it, and this is one of those great things about world cinema in general, is the ability to look into a different place, to see things that are done so very differently than what your personal experiences are, but to also recognize the universality of human experience in so many ways. I mean, to remake Pather Panchali in America would require little except the changing of, you know, the locations. The characters themselves could be transported to any culture. And I think that's part of what makes it such a beautiful particular experience. There's a at Cannes in 1956, it won Best Human Document. which is, sounds like one of those bullshit awards they make up to give somebody an award at a film festival. But it also actually really is perfect because it is. That's what it is. It's a document of humanity. It's not a document of Indian humanity. It's not a document of, you know, Bengali humanity specific to the region. It's a document of humanity. These are very identifiable characters having very identifiable problems in their lives that just happen to be set against a different backdrop.
It's true. And it should be said that this isn't a document at all of Satyajit Ray's family. Like, he grew up in a slightly more
well-to-do
family.
No, my man was doing it.
He grew up in a family of artists and writers. The Pather Panchali is based on a fairly famous at its time children's book trilogy. And here's a name I actually am going to really screw up by – oh, God. This is two words, and together it is like 30 letters. By Bibhuti Bhushan Bandyopadhyay.
Satyajit Ray.
But it was his autobiographical novel that he wrote. And it came across Satyajit Ray's path when he was working as an illustrator.
Can I just say one quick thing about your inability to say that name? Is that Indian names are some of the most beautiful musical names, and it says so much that Americans cannot pronounce them properly. They are – I mean, if that name was pronounced properly, it would be – no, I can't do it either. But I think it
do
would
you
be –
Do you want to try?
No, it would be – it would dance off the tongue of a native speaker. But our English is such a brutal language in so many ways that we just cannot do it.
I know. I feel very guilty for mangling that. But he came across the book when he was
his name again?
You try it. Try it. I want you to try it.
Bibhuti Bhushan Bandyopadhyay.
That's actually very convincing.
Does that sound good?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, actually.
You know, growing up in Queens, New York, you know a lot of Indian kids. So you sort of like – you kind of like pick up the – I mean, I'm sure I totally blew it, but you know, you can fake it a little.
You faked it really well.
We have amazing Indian food in Queens, Jackson Heights. Some of the best Indian food in America. Unreal, unreal Indian food. Sorry, go ahead.
Fair enough. So Satyajit Ray came across this book while he was working as a children's book illustrator, and that's when he fell in love with it. He never wrote a script for Pather Panchali. He fell in love with the story. He drew storyboards in his head. And then he just carried it out. So no script for this film actually exists. But he spent 3 years getting it made. And basically he did one of those things where it's like a child casting search. He has to find the young child who's going to play Apu. He looks at hundreds of kids who want to play Apu. He can't find anyone. There's like a story where in these giant casting calls, somebody tried to smuggle in a little girl and they had like shaved her head to make her look like a boy. And he caught onto it. And then his wife saw a really cute kid, you know, across the street. I think he was just hanging out on a building. And she was like, that's your Apu. And his name is Subir Banerjee. And this little kid looks the part. And he looks so good in this movie that I didn't realize till after the fact that Subir Banerjee was like infamous on the set of Pather Panchali because of his inability to act. Like, he was like the worst child actor ever. And Satyajit Ray was kind of bummed out about it. And they had to figure out tricks to make it look like the kid was acting.
They did a great job because I think the kid has a sense of naturalism to him. He doesn't have a lot of lines. That probably helps. Doesn't say a lot.
Yeah, the heavy listening. He listens and observes and everything else goes to his sister and mom.
Yeah, that probably helps a lot. The kid is the cutest kid, though. It's unreal. And watching him run around in the jungle is just joyful. He's wonderful. So what I love, though, about this movie, what – really drew me in is, again, walking in fully ignorant and watching the beginning of the movie and being like, all right, which one of these kids is Apu? And then, in fact, Apu is not in it until he's born and doesn't actually show up as a character about 25 minutes into the movie. And I love that approach to the story of a boy's life, that your life doesn't begin at birth. It begins before that. The people and the conditions into which you're born are just as important. And the way that his sister is really probably the real protagonist of this story. She's the central – and the mother, the central driving figures of the story. And the way that he orbits them from the outside, I really loved it. And it
– Yeah, I like that we had that time with the sister and the mother.
Right. I mean, it just makes a big difference. And the mother's, by the way, a great character. Here's the thing. Everybody in the movie is a great character because everybody in this movie has so many different dimensions that come across so subtly. Nobody has to get up and give a big speech about who they are. The mother can be both sad. She can be sad. She can be sweet. And she can be a bitch. She can be any of those three things at any time, just like any real person can be. And I love that about it, that he's not Rai is not pulling back from making the mom be like, you know, occasionally on the abusive side of things, but also making it very clear this is a woman trying very hard to just keep her shit together on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think you get that this is the woman responsible for keeping together people who don't even appreciate how much work she might be doing.
Right.
But at the same time, you see that the mother is, you know, smothering Durga, the daughter, all the time, you know, repressing her for what she thinks is her own good. You know, that there's never any question that the daughter might go to school. Like, they're talking about the son, but, like, nobody gives anything about whether or not the daughter, who seems so bright and so passionate
right.
and so connected to the world, and no one really cares. And you get all of the dimensions of that. Like, there's that scene where Apu is tempted by the acting troupe that comes into town, right. and he wants to be an actor. And so he digs through Durga's shoebox and of her toys, and he finds, like, foil, and he makes himself a crown. And Durga gets upset. I mean, you understand that she has almost nothing in this world that belongs to her.
Nobody has anything.
Nobody
None of these characters
anything.
Own anything. When grandma – when auntie moves out, she's got like a pot – literally a pot to piss in, although she drinks out of it, and a straw mat.
Yeah. People can pack up all their things here and just carry it from sleeping place to sleeping place. And yet when Durga gets mad at Apu, the mother just comes in and takes his side and tells Durga to grow up.
Right.
You know, and there's so much, like, casual injustice in this film, but you also feel empathy for everyone. Like, I feel so much empathy for the mother in this film.
Even the dad, who's kind of a dipshit for most of the movie, by the end of the movie, you come to a place where you feel for him. And he has this moment where he talks about his dreams and his hopes of what the world was going to be for him and his family and how none of it's been achieved. The movie is just so subtle and nuanced and loving to each of these characters. There are no villains in this movie.
No, and you know what's so fascinating is what I like about a random order of doing movies is I always just feel like I see a progression from film to film to film to film. And that the father here in Pather Panchali is so similar to Ray Milland's character in The Lost Weekend, in that he's a character who dreams of being a better person than right. he is, who's always putting things off, who always knows he can write this great novel.
He's getting stoned all the time.
Yeah.
Doing bong rips left and right.
But he's a frustrated writer who won't accomplish anything, and it's that same archetype again.
That's a really interesting character type to have here because obviously, you know, I don't have the deep personal experience or knowledge to discuss India's culture, especially at the time this movie is set, which is probably closer to the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. But the little clues are there. The dad talking about how he ran into an old friend of his father who wants him to officiate a religious ceremony, and there's a discussion of what caste that guy's in. And the idea that this guy who lives in this ancestral land in the jungle, you know, can he be a writer in this world? The same thing with Durga. The idea that, you know, the world into which she's born, her options are incredibly limited. And in fact, you know, I mean, spoilers, we're talking about the whole movie here, but her death almost reads metaphorical, that the idea that of being a bright young woman in this society – there's no future. There's nothing that she can do.
Right, except I think that
it's not metaphorical because it's based on a true story.
Yeah,
but I mean, well, it reads almost metaphorically for that reason, because the idea that she's trapped in this dead end society where, you know, there's no school for her. No matter how bright she is, her future is what she sees there with her auntie and her mother.
Right, and there's almost no way she could ever imagine her family saving up enough money to give her a dowry to get married like her friend does.
Right,
because
yeah,
we
she
see
came,
the elaborate right, preparation of the ceremony, and we see that look in her face where she just feels like this will never get to happen.
Right, she's trapped already. There's a beautiful scene in that wedding where it cuts to Durga, and the way that Rai has framed her, she has one lock of hair coming down over her face that creates the shadow of a tear down her cheek. I think it's one of the most beautiful images I have ever seen in a movie, and it speaks so much while just being just a shot of a girl in a crowd.
It is beautiful. And that pan that he does across where he doesn't show people's faces as much as he just concentrates on what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the women slicing eggplants in half. But yet at the same time, I feel like, you know, Apu's family clings to this idea that they might be slightly higher caste than the people around them because the father is learned and can read and write. In that, like, there's this interesting dimension where I feel like the father at one point kind of throws shade on their slightly richer neighbors because they're not as intelligent of a class as he is. And you see them look in the wife's face like, that doesn't matter when we can't eat.
It's such an interesting – again, this is one of those movies that I walk out of and it makes me want to explore aspects of a culture I don't understand as well because, the idea of what these class divides are within the world, because they've come back to an ancestral land to live, and it's not been a great choice. It's just not worked out for them. And at the end of the movie, they decide to just fuck it and get out of there. So like, what is the larger story of culturally where these people are? I mean, the movie gives you, I think, everything you need to know within the context, and it gives you everything you need to know, not just culturally but historically. Maybe my favorite sequence in the whole movie is when Durga and Apu finally go investigate the train whistle they hear. And they discover the electric lines, and it's a bizarre thing to them. They don't know what it is, and it's humming, and she listens to it, and it's strange and magical. And then the train comes, and that's strange and magical. That gives you exactly enough understanding of – for the first half of the movie, I was like, well, when is this anyway?
Yeah, it could have been at any time.
And then to see that modern world encroaching, what I then love is what Rai does is that when they go, they do this, they see the modern world that's so different from what they experience, you know, at home. And then they return, and as they return back to home, they find Auntie is dead. And so again, metaphorically, what has happened here is they have gone out. They have lost their innocence in a specific way, and they have moved past the old world that she represented, and so now she's dead.
Right, and this is a world she'll never get to see.
Right, and that's his choice that Rai made, because my minimal research on this movie, he changed her death from the book. She dies much earlier in the book and does not die in this way. And so that's a very specific choice. I love it because the movie, again, while there's a universality of everything that's going on, you know, here on screen that's so – everybody can identify with it. Rai is also speaking to things that are very much about his own nation and his own people and about his own culture. I love those levels of it, and it makes you want to get deeper and really keep exploring.
Yeah, and actually – about the actress's death, you know, Chunibala Devi, who played the old aunt, he had her act dead while she was there. You know, she was an 80-year-old woman. By the way, her backstory is amazing. She used to be a theater actress before the turn of the century. And then when they found her because she was working as a madam at a brothel.
Good for her.
So they rang the doorbell. Satyajit Rai rang the doorbell of this brothel because he had heard that an old woman worked there who used to be an actress.
Yeah, that's why he did it. Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, that's why I did it.
That's why I did it.
And the woman just was like, well, which one of these girls do you like? And he was like, I would like to put you in a movie. And she's like, what are you talking about? Who are you?
She's so great.
She's so great. And, you know, so in this death scene, he told her to act dead. And she like topples over and she hits her head on the ground. He immediately like runs over to hold her. And then they do the scene where they tie her up in the stretcher and they carry her corpse through the woods. She was apparently acting so dead that they didn't like remember to tell her to stop acting. And so she just kept acting dead because she was waiting for them to tell her to stop acting dead. And then everybody freaked out. And then she got mad. Like, why didn't I'm – is this shot over? Like, my eyes are closed. You guys could have told me this.
Yeah, she's so great. She's got such energy and fire in her. It would be really easy for this character to be a crone, but she's not. You know, she's fun. She's actually the one that like in the house, you kind of like, oh, you hang out with her. She's a really good time with, you know, encouraging Durga to steal a fruit. What definition of stealing, that fruit's on the ground, man. It belongs to anybody.
Yeah. And there's the idea that it used to be their orchard anyway.
Right. Once upon a time.
Yeah.
The beautiful layers of it. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk more about Ryan, some of these amazing performances in Pathar Panchali. Okay. We are back. You forgot to mention something.
Oh, yeah. That Auntie did a lot of her performance while drinking opium tea.
So she should have gone to Hollywood. She was ready for it.
And the sad thing about the Auntie story is she actually didn't live long enough for the film to be screened in Cannes. She died the year that it came out. But Satyajit Rai did bring the movie to her house, so she got to see it before she died, okay. But she never got to be recognized for her work.
So the screening history of this movie is weird. It premiered at MoMA.
Yeah.
Which is like one of those really interesting things where it seems like the rest of the world caught wind of this movie before the locals caught wind of this movie.
Yeah, well, what was happening is that this was a period in India when a lot of major directors were visiting India to shoot some films there. And so John Huston showed up and Satyajit Rai, because he was like that connected dude, was like, oh, I'll show you around India. Let me show you some neighborhoods. Let's talk movies. I would love to talk movies. Like, you're a famous director and I'm making my first movie. So he showed John Huston that first scene of the kids running through the fields of flowers, And John Huston basically went back to New York and was like, there is a huge talent about to show up in India. And he made the connections for him so that the film got showed when it was finished.
Yeah, so it premiered in MoMA, then it played in Calcutta, then it played at Cannes. Definitely an unusual release strategy for a movie like this. And I think it's part of this movie feels like it belongs strongly to international cinema in that way, which I don't mean that it's not Indian, but it does speak to that international I think they call it parallel cinema, that it really just belongs that a lot of different nations were kind of coming to sort of similar aesthetic understandings of film at the same time. And I love it. It's a period that I really love. And I love what Ryan does here, I think is really great. And what I think sometimes can be a problem in other films of this type is that he understands the balance between having something be sort of meandering and shaggy and also – while also advancing character and his minimal story. He hits that balance perfectly.
Yeah, the film has this kind of timber to it of you're watching just like – not the most important memories, but the thing that a person happens to remember. You know, like Auntie getting a new shawl and how happy she is right. to get a new shawl. And that these aren't the moments that a life turns on necessarily.
There's a couple of those.
There's a couple of those. But a lot of them are just like, you know, it fast forwards a few months and it shows up. And then there's just this little scene and Dirk is being accused of taking a necklace. And then it kind of goes away. And it's just like these are the – it has this haze to it that I kind of like where there's no real plot to speak of in that linear sense. And no sentimentality, which I think is really hard to pull off in a film like this. And it does it so wonderfully.
Yeah, it's not sentimental and it's never quite glorifying poverty. At the same time, it's never wallowing in the misery of poverty. It really, again, hits this middle note. It's so easy to make a movie about people who are poor and have it be really miserable and painful. I mean, it's really easy to make a movie about people who are poor and have it be about what plucky, great spirits they are. This is – I mean, it really gets both of those things, I think, that just because you're poor doesn't mean that you're living the worst life ever, that there are moments of joy and happiness in even the most impoverished life. And at the same time, also showing that being poor is horrible, that your daughter dies because there's nobody there to take care of her when she gets a fucking cold from the monsoon. You know, he really threads that needle perfectly.
Yeah, and I like the moments where we see how the kids deal with money, how they're, you know, they realize that they can't always beg their parents for money for candy, that they'll get shot down. And then they like run around to try to like get some extra candy from their friends who have richer parents.
Right.
And you admire their pluck and then you feel bad when the wealthier moms are like, don't give them candy, they're beggars. But then there's that scene later where the man shows up who has kind of that I don't even know what that contraption is called, where you can see pictures of the world around you.
It's kind of like a weird Nickelodeon thing.
A weird Nickelodeon thing. And they don't have any money for it. And then their dad, on his way to town, gives them some coins. And you realize that's the best investment, is showing them the world that maybe they might dream of seeing.
I think that's one of the things I also love about this movie, is that that exact aspect of it, there is a sense very often in this movie, and what makes Apu a really good quote-unquote central character, is that he sees everything with a real sense of wonder and joy. And that attitude really permeates the film. I mean, that scene of them finding the power lines again, just the way that shot, just the very subtlety of the way that shot. I've seen a million power lines in my life, but it feels magical and new within the context of what Rai is doing here. And it's because it's from that POV of Apu. They see the train coming and it's just over on the ridgeline and they run through the grass to get to it. I mean, like, it's just like this moment of like absolute discovery, even though, again, I've seen 100,000 fucking trains go by in my time. But the beauty of that moment, he doesn't have to focus on Apu's face to get it across. The way that he frames it, the way that he brings it together, instills that feeling in us.
Well, because the film has been so – not hushed, because there's been a lot of yelling and bickering, but so insular in that moment that to get this huge vista – you know, the first like huge vista shot that we really have is in the sequence – and then something so foreign to anything he's shown us before, right. It is a shock to everybody.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's a good point that so much of the movie takes place in that courtyard previously. One of the things I love, and it's the way that he does small things with the movie, with things like there's a scene where the mother wakes up and leaves the courtyard and she unlocks the door and then closes it behind her. And we know there's a giant hole in the wall directly next to her. And I love that because it just speaks so much to who she is and the kind of life that she's trying to live. Later on, when she kicks Durga out of the house, he uses that hole so perfectly to frame where the mother has closed the door on Durga. Durga is in the jungle and is crying, and the mother collapses in front of the door. And we can see both of those things because of that hole in the wall. And right. then the wall itself creates a division between the characters in the frame. It is – this is a first film from a guy who is – you know, it's early in the history of cinema, and he's in a nation that is not necessarily at the forefront of cinema.
And he has no money.
He has no money. And his control of cinematic language is perfect. You just don't see shots like that. You know, they're just so simple but perfect. It's wonderful. It's gorgeous.
And then it gets recalled again when the father comes home and there's been a storm and that hole
right.
has just collapsed and right. everything has collapsed. I mean – this film is astonishing. I feel like a lot of those magical shots came just from Satyajit Ray spending so long trying to get the film made that he had time to discover things about that world. You know, like that final shot where – not final, final, but where Apu throws the necklace into the lake so that nobody will ever know that his that Durga did actually steal it after right. all, so that her like reputation will never be – will be shamed in death. Actually came from Satyajit, like, sitting at the bank, throwing a rock or something in the pond and being like, that's an amazing image. You know, and the way that it just gets sealed over by the jungle.
Well, I want to say about that necklace and the way that it wraps up Durga's story. Durga, I love that character. I thought she was incredible. And, you know, the way that she's played, that's the last thing I expected was to walk out of this movie and say my favorite character in this movie is the doomed sister.
But that's a lot of how I felt about Boyhood. Like, I walked out of Boyhood and I was like, I love
– yeah, it's funny because this is Lorelei. Like Indian Boyhood yeah. or Boyhood is American Pather Panchali. Yeah. That's similar thing where the older sister is actually kind of the cooler, better character. You know, but at least in Pather Panchali, the problem in Boyhood is that she doesn't get enough to do.
Yeah, and she vanishes.
Pather Panchali, though, Durga gets not just a lot to do. She has an entire story and an arc, and it's a tragic one, but it's a strong one as well.
Yeah, like it's kind of heartbreaking for me watching her arc go on in the film where you realize even in the best case scenario, she's probably going to have a life as hard as her mom's.
Right.
And to see her become the woman that her mom is, to see that bitterness slowly start to take a hold of her before the end, to see her just get disillusioned and be like, well, my life is going to be cooking and being petty and who has salt and who took my oil and who's got my chilies.
Right.
To realize that this like magical girl is going to get beaten down by circumstance before what happens to her happens is heartbreaking.
And that ends up making the ending of the movie really interesting, which is, you know, as the family is leaving and they're in the back of that ox cart looking behind them, not sure what is ahead of them, there's sort of the hope that Apu can find something better than the dead end that his sister had. From beginning to end, I really love this movie. And it's tough. This – I'm going to say like a really fucking privileged, shitty thing people at home are not going to appreciate. But in this job, sometimes it's really hard to sit down and watch a movie because you're just not in the fucking mood. Like, it's just like there's certain movies like you need to be in like a mood to watch. And this movie, you know, it's like a 1955 black and white Indian movie that I knew was going to be slow. And I was like, I'm not in the headspace right now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I want to play a video game. Like, that's what I felt like when I sat down to watch this. And 4 minutes in, I was just in. And yeah. I think that's the power of a really great movie. You don't have to come to it with the right mindset. It will create the mindset for you. And this film does that. It's unbelievable. And so by the end of the movie, and then the halfway point, the other thing about this movie that I love is at the halfway point, as the narrative sort of comes into focus, the minor narrative of the mother trying to keep this family together and, you know, the sort of clash between her hopes and the dreams of the father and the realities of the world, I found myself just really deeply, I mean, just giving such a shit.
When the auntie got a shawl, I was so happy. And then when the mom was upset with how she got the shawl, I was so upset.
Yeah, but I get it though. I get it. At the same time, that's the one thing I like. This movie is so great is that I get why the mother's upset because she has to go beg somebody else for the shawl. It makes the family look bad. I get that. That's like
– I 100% get that.
So I mean like I get every piece of that.
And yet you're at the same time, you're like, doesn't this woman deserve a nice shawl before she dies?
I mean she does, but the family can't give her one. Like,
yeah.
And it's because the dad's a dipshit, frankly. I do like seeing that all cultures have shitty dads. It's not just American culture. All cultures have shitty dads. Good. I can feel connections with everybody around the world. So that's I guess this is just like us just saying all the good things. There's nothing about – I don't think there's a thing in this movie. My only complaint about this movie is that this is one of those old movies where the opening credits is 2 minutes long, and I'm like, come on, just skip it. How did they ever decide to make movies that way? With like just an endless block of credits at the beginning.
I think it must just be because they expect people to be sitting down with popcorn. Like people are just filing in still or
they
something.
They don't expect people to have – I guess that's the thing. That's how the old overtures on the road shows went. It's like take your fucking seats now.
Yeah, come on. Let's get this started. It's like the flicking of the lights in the lobby.
Yeah, because
that's – I don't know if that's true. That's just my first
guess. It's just one of those things you watch – it's literally 2.5 minutes of credits on this in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And you're like – What is happening in the theater when this is happening?
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of technical things I want to point out that I just really liked. Like I like how when the dad disappears for 5 months and he writes a letter and then they read the letter aloud, the way he records the sound of the dad's voice sounds like it's coming from miles away over a recorder. It's not a smooth layover. He sounds like he's in outer space, which is really neat. I don't know. I'm like nervous about saying this.
Say you're culturally clueless shit.
What I was going to say is sometimes I get annoyed at movies where they have just endless series of close-ups of people that are inscrutable. You know, because sometimes I feel like a movie has endless series of inscrutable close-ups of people and it's because they just don't know what's happening.
Well, it's tough.
But with, this movie does.
It's tough with movies that are lower budget and have non-professional actors often, because those characters are perhaps not being inscrutable. The actors are just incapable of getting across anything.
Yeah.
I don't find that problem in this movie.
No, though. Me neither. That's the thing I was trying to like get around to saying that I actually – like I found myself loving the inscrutable close-ups and usually I'm like, come on. You have the few, there's usually way too many inscrutable close-ups in movies like this.
No, I found that these characters – even the amateur actors in the movie, the townspeople, I felt like – Rye was able to direct them properly to give the one look that I understood what they were doing. I mean, you're right. 2 minutes to it. And this is not a foreign film thing. This is an American film thing, too.
Yeah, this is an every film thing.
This is an every film. So an actor just can't get across an interior emotion. And the camera gets in tight as if we're supposed to just read their mind.
Yeah, it gets in tight and then it puts some music over it. It's like, that's an acting scene. You're like, no, it's not an acting scene. You, by the way, the way that they got that scene where this Apu kid was such a bad actor. Subir Banerjee. I never made another movie after this. When they found him later, I think he was working as a welder. Maybe he just disappeared. He became one of those
too pretty to be a welder. Such a good looking little kid.
He became one of those mythical figures in India. But he was such a bad actor that even in that scene where he's supposed to be walking across the field looking for his sister, he couldn't walk normally. Like he was just a bad walker. And so what Satyajit had to do was he had to build little obstacles in the path he was supposed to walk in. So the kid would have to pause and like step over it. And then he had different people from the crew hide in the field of flowers and then just keep yelling out the kid's name so that he would stop and look around. Because otherwise the kid just could not even walk through a field and look around.
You know what's funny is that have you done any screen acting?
No. We did a movie together where you did all the talking and I just had to sit there.
I've done a couple of like little cameo things. There's nothing harder. I did a cameo thing on a web series where I had to put a can of soda on a counter. There's nothing fucking harder than putting a can of soda on a counter. Like, it's crazy how hard the most obvious stuff is to do convincingly when there's a camera on you. It's really weird. So I have a lot of fucking feelings for this kid right now. Because I'm not convinced that I could walk across a field convincingly.
There's a reason why I don't act. But I think you're a good actor.
I think I did okay in the thing that we did. It's an indie movie called The California No. It's in a post-production right now. Shout out to Ned Eber.
I just like that scene because you had to do all the dialogue.
Well, I did all the dialogue, but that's actually easier for me than just putting a can of – I mean, I swear to God, this web series of Video Game High School I did, I had to put a can of soda on a counter and I had to take 15 takes.
What were you doing wrong?
It was too hard. I was often doing it too soft. Because it was like a can of soda on a glass counter, and I was just so aware of putting it down that it becomes like a thing. Like your brain gets in the way of just an automatic thing that you should be able to do.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm also like very aware of like, is the soda properly positioned? Like you're just so aware of it that you become totally phony. And so having done even that little bit of acting and that little bit, my basic respect for acting, even not very good acting, has escalated.
Will you put this coffee cup down? I just want to see you do it.
That was so phony. I'm like aware that I'm putting it. So that's the thing. So any director who can get good performances out of non-professionals, my respect for them is over the fucking moon, because it is – you put a non-professional in front of a situation where they're become very self-conscious of what they're doing, like this kid walking across a field, and it just becomes the weirdest, most bizarrely phony thing you've ever seen. So that Rye was able to figure out this system – a guy, again, with no film experience, able to figure that out, I think is incredible. So,
100% agree.
There's one thing I do want to say that I looked up, and I want to say that I'm very proud of. I looked up and I found this out. Subhadra Mitra, who is the cinematographer on this picture, 21-year-old guy, never picked up a camera in his life, shot this fucking movie. Over time, him and Rye did a bunch of movies together, and then eventually they broke up because Rye was like a little too hands-on with the camera. But over the course of the making of the Apu trilogy, not on this film but the next film, he invented the lighting technique called bounce lighting.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like one of like the fundamental modern cinematography techniques. And it's the idea of aiming a light not at the person but at an object off from the person to create a diffuse light that looks like it's coming in through a window or from the sun. And it is like one – it's like one of the most basic aspects. And it's unreal to me that this guy who had no experience in India invented this. Later on, some Swedes took credit for it.
Well, that's just like a Swede.
But it was in fact the Indians that did it. And it's unreal. A 21-year-old guy never picked up a camera in his life, shot this movie. This is a gorgeous movie.
And there are some beautiful scenes. I love the scene when the father finally comes home, and it's so tense because you know what the father is about to find out.
Right.
And they put the camera kind of mid-range at the people. She finally tells him, and like she starts sobbing, and then the dad stands up and gets out of frame and then comes back down and he's screaming. Like that's amazing.
It's really unreal. You understand why John Huston saw this footage and was like, oh, this is a talent, because this is – if you told me that this – if you just showed me this movie and did not tell me this was a guy's first movie and a cinematographer's first movie, I would have been like, oh, they're very good. Now I'm like, oh, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
It's just they breathe – they live and breathe film.
Random fun fact. There was a while in the 70s when Satyajit Ray was trying to shop a script for a movie called The Alien around Hollywood, and nobody wanted to make it. And then about a decade later, Steven Spielberg made E.T., and Satyajit Ray claimed that E.T. was stolen from his script, and he was really mad about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not know that. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, yeah. Spielberg's defense was like he was in high school when that script was out, and he was like, come on, you're insane. But like Satyajit Ray always believed that that was his script that turned into E.T. Like he became the first and only Indian filmmaker to get an honorary Academy Award, which he got in 1992, and then he died 24 days later.
That's like some kind of weird Hollywood version of The Ring. You will get an Oscar and you will die 24 days later.
That's so creepy. This is like a little off topic, but I've been trying to look up certain people for certain jobs for the podcast that I'm doing. And I was trying to look up people who were bird handlers on The Notebook. And I looked up a person last night who was like one of the waterfowl experts on The Notebook. And he died this weekend. And I felt like I'd made it happen.
Probably. Yeah. You did it. I agree.
Probably.
One last quick break. When we come back, we will make our final votes. This is a real cliffhanger. I don't know how we're going to go on this one. So let's come back from break and find out where we stand on Pathar Panchali. All right, we're back. Pathar Panchali, by the way, Stan, is a song of the little road or a song of the open road.
Path actually just means path.
Yeah. In fact, my whole life – this is a movie I had not seen, but I was, aware of. And in my brain, it was always something about doing Panthers.
Yeah, me too. I always inserted that N.
Well, it says the N in Panchali. It's very confusing. And we're stupid, blubbering Americans. So it's
– That is awesome.
What do you expect?
Can you imagine if they did this whole movie but with the cats? Like if it was actually just about those kittens that they throw around the whole time in the courtyard?
Man, they abuse the shit out of those cats. They throw a sack on a cat and throw other stuff on the sack. And I'm like, that cat is not
– Yeah, they're okay. Just throwing stuff around
this
cats.
Is not – that's the one time I didn't like Auntie was when she was just tossing cats hard to the ground. A different way of dealing with domesticated animals in this time and place.
Yeah, so Panther Panchali is when the kittens get their revenge.
You know what's really funny is that one of the reasons why I chose this is that, one, we had people on the message board saying why all the American movies. Two, Criterion had sent me a free copy of the Apu trilogy on Blu-ray. And I was like, well, this is a good opportunity to see it. And three, because Jungle Book was out. And I was like, fuck it. Like, you know, this Indian kid in the jungle. Let's just do an Indian kid in the jungle. You know, I don't think there's more connections than I expected. Just in terms of the idea of like family and finding your place and like, you know, interacting with the world in general. Favreau's Jungle Book is not the same movie as this by any
means. Not even close.
But just sort of that looseness the Jungle Book has because it's an episodic movie, in the same way this is slightly episodic. With the idea that the central kids, I think both being non-actors who deliver shockingly charismatic performances, that I think that maybe the director was able to tease out of them, maybe not necessarily. I think also things are set in the same general area. I believe. I think Bengal. I'm gonna get nailed in this one, but I think that Bengal is in the east of India, which is where I think. Anyway. I should say, while on the topic of Jungle Book, go to birthmoviesdeath.com and find Sid Adlaka's article. He went to the Penj National Forest, which is the jungle that the Jungle Book is set in. And while he was there on safari, there was a tiger poisoning.
A tiger poisoning?
Yeah, it's like a whole thing. So we have like real investigative journalism happening over at BMD.
Did they kill the tiger?
A poisoned tiger would, in fact, be a dead tiger.
Aww.
There's a very limited number of tigers. They're super endangered, but there are people living in the area who are competitive with the tigers for their livestock. And so a tiger will feed for a number of days on a kill. And so what the locals will do is they'll find a carcass the tiger is feeding on. They'll poison it. So when the tiger comes back, it'll get poisoned and stop killing their livestock.
Oh, that's terrible. I wish we could help them build fences that tigers can't get through so everybody could work this out.
Well, it's really interesting. It is thematically similar, you know, real world Jungle Book and this movie, which is the encroachment between modern and sort of more ancient things. And the idea that our modern need to protect tigers because they are endangered really encroaches on these people's ancient need to just fucking grow their own food. So it's just really, you know, in the same way that the train cuts through, you know, Apu's jungle, the same way that fire devastates Mowgli's jungle in Jungle Book, the same way that, you know, our meddling in this stuff, the natural world and the human world, the modern world and the older world are often at loggerheads. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, and there's no good solution.
You know, I brought that all together just off the top of my head. I wasn't even planning that. I just wanted to like big up Sid a little bit because he's a real good writer, and he's my Indian cred. So you're just getting the head shake right now. When I was a kid, you know what's funny? So when I was a kid growing up in Queens, I would say that we had more Indian Americans than probably most other places in America, I would say. We had like a real population of Indians. And one of my friends growing up was this kid named Sanjay. Great guy. He's married now. He's got little kids of his own. My uncle said this thing, though, when I was a kid, sort of like this, I think the difference between a name like Apu, which probably in 55 in America felt really foreign. And today Apu, besides The Simpsons, I think just in general, the changing demographics of America doesn't feel that way. My uncle at the time in like 1981, my racist uncle, was like, your friend Sanjay, that sounds like something a Tarzan would say to call the elephants to him. And but I don't think the name Sanjay doesn't feel far. It doesn't feel exotic anymore.
No, I think it's a lovely name.
Always was. But I feel like culturally it doesn't feel like an exotic name anymore. And that's one of the things I kind of like about getting old is like I like seeing that curve of history. That stuff like the Apu trilogy, you know, a film from India seemed just so – in 55 when this played at MoMA must have been like – exoticism to the extreme. People probably just showed up to see what those Indians were doing. You know what I mean? Like, but today, it doesn't feel distant and, you know, impossible to imagine. The world slowly gets smaller, and it's because of movies like this that introduce us to other peoples in other places and that show the basic humanity that we all share that allows that over time, that these things that were exotic, you know, 30 years ago when I was a kid in grade school, and 50 or, you know, 70 years ago when this movie was first, you know, premiering, isn't as exotic anymore. I think it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, it does really speak to the way that movies are able to show us people and their lives in a way that's special, both in documentary form and in fiction, that almost maybe fiction can sometimes be more powerful than documentary.
I think fiction is more powerful than documentary. Yeah. I think it usually is, because you can kind of fudge the stuff in a different way that allows you to sort of see the humanity that we all share. This has really turned into some fucking bullshit.
Yeah, this is awful. So let's just say yes. I'm just going to say yes.
I'm like the angry guy in this. Here I am about like how Pather Panchali has really reminded me of the universal feelings that we all as humans share. Like, this is embarrassing. This is bad for my brand, frankly. Fuck you, Satyajit Ray. Fuck you. yes, this is an easy yes on the canon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is 100% yes. I'm glad we did this. The only disappointing thing for me was when this film ended, I had to watch our next movie that we're going to do for the canon next week, and I couldn't just sit there and watch the whole trilogy.
I'm going to space those out. I think it's maybe plausible that we'll do the rest of the trilogy over the course of this show. We'll save them and dole them out as we go along. Next time somebody complains that we're just doing a bunch of American movies from the 90s.
I'd be like, God, stop it with the Indian films already.
So it's up to you guys now. Please go to the Earwolf forums. There's a canon forum. There'll be a pinned thread where you can vote and leave your comments. I don't want to underestimate our brilliant listeners, but I suspect a number of our listeners will have a similar experience to us, which is this will be a first time watching this movie. And I hope to, you know, hear some people's different opinions and thoughts on experiencing a different kind of cinema that they maybe weren't expecting. Because again, I think we'd say an indie movie is Bollywood. That's what you automatically think of as Bollywood. It's like the second biggest film industry in the world. But there's a lot more going on.
That just makes me wonder, like, what would we think if everybody thought all American films were just the Avengers?
They do. That's what they do. That's what people think overseas. I mean, that's the thing to keep in mind, is that overseas, all people think that America – it's so funny, because somebody was talking about Daredevil, the Daredevil TV show. And in the Daredevil TV show in season two, this evil corporation has ninjas. There's a Japanese corporation. And some guy said, well, what if – you know, imagine if in Japan they had a show where the American corporation, their security was all cowboys. And everybody – people were like, A, that's amazing. But B, that is sort of what other countries sort of see of America. It's Coca-Cola and John Wayne, and now it's Batman and Captain America. You know, so it's your big cultural products that define how other nations see you in a big way.
It is true. When I used to go abroad a lot in high school and then in college, I liked telling people I was from Texas, even during the period when I was living in Oklahoma.
Because they thought you were a fucking cowgirl, right?
Yeah. They could immediately picture what my life was like. Even if it wasn't my life, they had a picture for it. Whereas if I said I was from Oklahoma, one person said, oh, do you like the Hansons? And another person was like, teepees? But other than that, nobody had any idea what I was talking about.
No, but you say you're from Texas. You go overseas, you're from Texas. Yeah. I mean, especially a bunch of years ago. I mean, you know, as the internet, I think, has changed a lot of how we see each other. But people assume you were riding a bucking bronco on the weekends, and I think that's great.
I think it's cool. Yeah.
I think it's cool. I think that sometimes, you know, those broad cultural strokes are not always accurate, but sometimes they're pretty awesome. The same thing with me as a New Yorker. People's visions of what my life is when I would go overseas. You know, actually, when I went to go, I visited my dad in Illinois when I was like 13, and I was telling kids that I was from New York, and they all assumed I was in a gang. Because I was from New York.
That's a pretty safe assumption, actually. So I've
only ever been in one gang fight my whole life. So I'm not even – that doesn't even count. I'll save that story for when we do the Warriors.
Which we should do the Warriors.
All right. This is the most –
all right. Yeah. We
have some real rambling wrap-ups lately. Okay. So anyway, it's up to you guys to vote. Please do so. Next week, our movie is going to be Brokeback Mountain, the gay cowboys eating pudding movie, as South Park put it. Is there pudding in Brokeback Mountain? Because Cartman talks about gay cowboys eating pudding as like what indie movies are. And it was very specifically a little cracky.
I can't picture. I feel like there's a moment where he says no to cherry cake. I can't picture any pudding.
I haven't rewatched it yet. Amy already has.
Also, the film writer hates it being referred to as the gay cowboy movie.
So next week it's the gay cowboy movie, Brokeback Mountain. Right now – is it right now? What day is today? Yeah, right now you can go on howl.fm and you can get our commentary track for Freaks. It has dropped last week, and it's available right now. If you want to go to howl.fm, you have to go to the actual website and sign up for an account and use the promo code CANON, C-A-N-O-N, to get one free month of Howl. Every single month we're delivering a different commentary track on a different movie that we have already inducted into the canon. That's the end of the show. Amy, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at MTV News or on Twitter at TheAmyNicholson.
And you can find me at DevinCF on Twitter and every single goddamn day at birthmoviesdeath.com. Guys, thank you for listening and thank you for joining us for the movies that are a little lesser known, are a little more esoteric, and are also new to us as well. Although there's a bunch of these fucking people are going to be like, watched this movie 10 years ago. How stupid are you, Devin? Film Twitter. Go suck it. All right, bye.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.